rewarding hard work once again, because that's what we've got to do as a country. You know, one in five of the men and women who go out to work in our country do their bit, make their contribution, put in the hours, and find themselves in low pay. With Britain's traditions, with Labour's traditions, that should shame us all, friends. So our first national goal is that we halve the number of people in low pay by 2025, transforming the lives of 2 million people in our country. The principle of together says we don't just use the talents of all, we reward the talents of all. And the minimum wage has got to become a route to bringing up your family with dignity. So we will raise the minimum wage by £1.50 an hour by 2020 to over £8 an hour, a rise in pay of £60 a week for a full-time worker on the minimum wage, or more than £3,000 a year. The Tories are the party of wealth and privilege. Labour is the party of hard work, fairly paid. And it's not just the low paid, but it's all working people who should have their talents rewarded. So our second national goal is that all working people should share fairly in the growing wealth of the country. That means as the economy grows, the wages of everyday working people grow at the same rate. You know what's amazing, friends, is that that statement, that goal, is even controversial. It used to be taken for granted in our country that that's what would happen. That's what the cost of living crisis, which the Tories don't understand, is all about. And to counter it, you need a government with a singular focus on tackling it. And key to this is transforming our economy so we create good jobs at decent wages. And that requires a massive national effort, the principle of together, everybody playing their part. For government, it means no vested interest, no old orthodoxy, no stale mindset should stand in the way of restoring this basic bargain of Britain. So it means reforming our banks, much bigger reform of our banks, breaking up the big banks. So that we have the competition we need in our banking system. It means getting power out of Whitehall. We are far too centralised a country. It's time we did something about it. It's time we transferred power out of Whitehall to our businesses, towns and cities, so that they can create the jobs, the prosperity, the wealth that they need. It's about businesses and trade unions engaging in cooperation, not confrontation. And it's also about something else, friends, for this party. It's using our historic values to fight for those at the front line of the modern workforce. I'm talking about a group of people that we in the Labour Party haven't talked about that much, and we need to talk about them a lot more. The growing army of our self-employed. 5 million people in our country, often the most entrepreneurial, go-getting people in Britain who have a hard, insecure life very often. You see, because of the jobs they do, 2 out of 3 don't have a pension. 1 in 5 can't get a mortgage. They don't want special treatment. They just want a fair shot. So the task for this Labour Party is to end this 21st century modern discrimination, and it is to fight and deliver equal rights for the self-employed in Britain. I said earlier that we need to create good jobs at decent wages to transform our economy, those jobs of the future. So our third national goal is that by 2025, Britain becomes truly a world leader in the green economy, creating 1 million new jobs as we do. You know, under this government, we're falling behind Germany, Japan, the United States, even India and China when it comes to green technology and services. And there are so many brilliant businesses who are desperate to do their bit, but government's not playing its part. With our plan, we will. And this is what we're going to do. We're going to commit to taking all of the carbon out of electricity by 2030. We're going to have a green investment bank with powers to borrow and attract new investment. And as Caroline Flint will announce tomorrow, we will devolve power and resources to communities so we can insulate 5 million homes over the next 10 years. You see, the environment isn't that fashionable anymore in politics, as you may have noticed with David Cameron. But it matters. It's incredibly important for our economy. And there is no more important issue for me when I think about my children's generation and what I can do in politics than tackling global climate change. Now, we need a plan for jobs, we need a plan for wages, we need a plan that is going to actually help the working families of our country. But at the heart of our plan, for our country and for your family, is also a future for all of our young people. I met somebody called Elizabeth the other day. Where is she? She's here. Elizabeth, why don't you stand up for one second? So Elizabeth is an apprentice. Elizabeth is an apprentice. She's an auto electrician. I think it's fair to say, Elizabeth, that you are breaking through in what up to now has been pretty much a man's world.
Yeah.
Now, let's have another round of applause for her and the great job she's doing. She's one of the lucky few, friends. She's one of the lucky few. Actually, Elizabeth's school, because I met her yesterday, Elizabeth's school helped her to get an apprenticeship. But so many other schools don't do that. In fact, lots of the young people I meet who are on apprenticeships say, oh, my school said apprenticeships were rubbish and they wouldn't help me. But now I'm doing it, you know, it's really great for me. But frankly, there aren't enough of them and they aren't high quality enough. So our fourth national goal is that by 2025, as many young people will be leaving school or college to go on to an apprenticeship as currently go to university. Now, I've got to tell you, this is an absolutely huge undertaking. We are such a long way away from this as a country. It is going to require a massive national effort. It's going to require young people to show the ambition to do well and to get on. It's going to require schools to lead a dramatic change in education with new gold standard technical qualifications. And it is going to need business and government to lead a revolution in apprenticeships. You know, government is very good at preaching to business about what it should be doing. Let me just tell you, government is absolutely useless when it comes to apprenticeships. And it's true of governments of both parties. Look at other countries like Germany and other countries. They do a fantastic job in giving apprenticeships to the next generation. We don't do that in this country. So first, we've got to tackle the failure by government. Then we've got to say to business that you've got to play your part. If you want to bring in a worker from outside the European Union, that's okay, but you must provide apprenticeships to the next generation. You see, we can't have what's happening at the moment in IT, where you've got more and more people coming in, but actually the number of apprenticeships falling in IT. And we've also got to say to business this: we're going to give you the control of the money for apprenticeships for the first time, but in exchange, if you want a major government contract, then you must provide apprenticeships to our young people. A plan for jobs, for wages, for education. But what is it? What other things give us confidence and security in life? It's the love of people we care most about. It's decent work, properly rewarded. But it's also the confidence and security of having a home of your own. And so many people don't have that today. That very British dream of home ownership is fading for so many people. You know, under this government, we're building fewer homes than at any time since the 1920s. So our fifth national goal says that by 2025, for the first time in 50 years, this country will be building as many homes as we need, doubling the number of first-time buyers in our country. Again, it's going to require a massive national effort, a massive national effort. We won't let large developers sit on land. We'll say to small developers and construction companies that we'll help them to build homes again in our country. We'll build a new generation of towns, garden cities, and suburbs, creating over 500,000 new homes. And we'll also make housing the top priority for additional capital investment in the next parliament. This party will get Britain building again. But your family also needs public services you can rely on. Education, policing, transport. And nowhere is that more true than our National Health Service. I mentioned earlier on that I spent a couple of days at a hospital in Watford earlier on this year. And while I was there, I met an amazing man called Colin in his 80s, who sadly died a few weeks later. But I will always remember my conversations with him. You see, he remembered the foundation of the NHS. He remembered what life was like before the National Health Service. And I remember him saying to me, "Ed, the problem then was you were on your own having to pay for medical treatment." Friends, we are so proud of our National Health Service. And I know my duty to Colin and to the British people. It is to make sure our NHS is there when we need it. So our sixth national goal is that we create a truly world-class 21st century health and care service, because a hospital is only as good as the services in the community. You see, that's the biggest lesson I learnt in Watford. If people can't get to see their GP, if elderly people can't get the visits they need, then they end up in hospital when it could have been avoided. And that's bad for them, and it's bad for the taxpayer. It costs billions of pounds. And let's face it, friends, those services are creaking. Those services are creaking just now. One in four people can't get to see their GP within a week. We've had the scandal of home care visits for the elderly restricted to just 15 minutes. In this day and age, the NHS does face huge challenges over the coming years. We will transform our NHS. It's time to care about our NHS. We need doctors, nurses, midwives, care workers who are able to spend proper time with us, not rushed off their feet. So we will set aside resources so that we can have in our NHS 3,000 more midwives, 5,000 more care workers, 8,000 more GPs, and 20,000 more nurses. An NHS with time to care. And in order to pay for it, we won't borrow an extra penny. or raise taxes on ordinary working families. We'll clamp down on tax avoidance, including tax loopholes by the hedge fund to raise over £1 billion. We will use the proceeds of a mansion tax on homes above £2 million. And we will raise extra resources from the tobacco companies who make soaring profits on the back of ill health. Because friends, the principle of building it together means everyone playing their part in making our NHS what it needs to be. In total, we'll set aside £2.5 billion in an NHS time to care fund. And tomorrow, Andy Burnham will set out our integrated plan for physical health, mental health, and care for the elderly. Truly a 21st century National Health Service. The stakes are incredibly high at this election, and nowhere more so than on the National Health Service, because we know the NHS is sliding backwards under this government. We know they're privatising and fragmenting it. Just imagine what another 5 years of David Cameron would mean for our National Health Service, friends. We are not going to let it happen. Our NHS is too precious, too important, and we will not let it happen. Friends, we built the NHS. We saved the NHS. We're going to repeal the Health and Social Care Bill, and we're going to transform our NHS for the future. That is what the next Labour government will do. And friends, we will do it together. Six national goals, friends. Six national goals to transform our country. Not a false promise on day one. Not some pie-in-the-sky idea that can't be delivered. Real, concrete ideas that can transform our country, that can restore faith in the future. A plan for Britain's future. Labour's plan for Britain's future. But to make that happen, we also have to do something else and transform who has power in our country so that those who feel locked out feel let back in. You know, people think Westminster politics is out of touch, irrelevant, and often disconnected from their lives. As somebody who stands at Prime Minister's questions each Wednesday, I often know what they mean. Look, we might as well say it. It's what people think about politics. They think it's not about them. And we've got to change it. We don't just need to restore people's faith in the future with this economic and social plan. We need to change the way politics works in this country. What does that mean? Well, first of all, it's time to hear the voice of young people in our politics. So we will give the vote to 16 and 17-year-olds in general elections. It's time to complete the unfinished business of reform of the House of Lords so we truly have a Senate of the nations and regions. And it's time to devolve power in England. And I'm incredibly proud of our proposals, our ambitious proposals, to reverse a century of centralisation. And there can be no better place to be talking about this than here in Manchester. Devolving power to local government, bringing power to closer to people right across England. And we need bigger reform of our constitution. But here's the thing, friends. Given everything we know about what people think of Westminster politics, it's got to be led by the people. It can't be some Westminster stitch-up. That's why we need a proper constitutional convention harnessing the civic energy and spirit of people right across our land. England, Scotland, Wales, every part of the United Kingdom. But you know, I've realised something else. Giving people voice is also about recognising who we are as a country. You see, we are more than ever four countries and one. England, Scotland, Wales, Northern Ireland, and Britain too. Each nation making its contribution. We're not just better together, we are greater together. And that's not something to fear. That's something to be proud of. You know, I learned something really important, as I'm sure we all did, in this referendum campaign. All of those people who are proud to be Scottish and proud to be British. Just like there are so many people who are proud to be Welsh and proud to be British. No one more so than our brilliant First Minister of Wales, Carwyn Jones. And let's hear it for him today, ladies and gentlemen. And so too, we can be proud to be English and proud to be British. And I say to this party, we must fight for these traditions and not cede them to others. Englishness, a history of solidarity from the Battle of Cable Street against Oswald Mosley and the Brown and the Black Shirts to the spirit of the Blitz. Englishness, traditions of fairness, from the Ford workers at Dagenham who fought for equal pay, to today's campaigners for the living wage. Englishness, a spirit of internationalism, from those who fought in the Spanish Civil War, to our generosity to those overseas. Now, friends, there'll be some people who tell you that being English, Welsh, or Scottish means dividing or setting ourselves against each other. Rubbish! Why? Because here's what we, the Labour Party, know. The injustices facing working people face them right across the United Kingdom. And we can only tackle them together. That is, after all, what we spent the last 2 years fighting for. And I am not going to let anyone, after the last 2 years, drive us apart. And if David Cameron cares so much about the union, why is he seeking to divide us? He's learning the wrong lessons from Scotland. He's learning the wrong lessons from Scotland. Because what he doesn't understand is that the lessons are, of course, about the Constitution. But they are not about playing political tactics about England. And here's why he's doing it. David Cameron doesn't lie awake at night thinking about the United Kingdom. He lies awake at night thinking about the United Kingdom Independence Party, UKIP. That is why he is doing it, friends. And I say, pandering to them is just one more reason why he is not fit to be the Prime Minister of this great country. So better together across the United Kingdom, but also better together true to our traditions of internationalism. And nowhere is that more true than when it comes to Europe and the European Union. Friends, let me say it plainly. Let me say it plainly. Our future lies inside, not outside, the European Union. We need to reform Europe. We need to reform Europe on the economy, on immigration, on benefits, on all of these big issues. But here is the question for Britain. How do we reform Europe? Do we reform Europe by building alliances or by burning alliances? Well, look, what's really good is that we've had a recent experience, a test case by David Cameron of his strategy. I don't know whether you missed it, but it's about somebody called Jean-Claude Juncker. Right, and in case you missed the score, it's not so good from his point of view, that's David Cameron's, because he lost by 26-2. Now, why did he lose? Why did he lose? Because at the start, people thought he might win that vote. I'll tell you why. Because, you see, the problem for our country is that when David Cameron comes calling, people don't think he's calling about the problems of Britain or the problems of Europe. They think he's calling about the problems of the Conservative Party. And here's the funny thing, friends. And here's the funny thing. If you're elected the Chancellor of Germany, or the Prime Minister of Italy, or the President of France, you don't really think you were elected to solve the problems of the Conservative Party. That's why he can't succeed for our country. And look, what we had over Jean-Claude Juncker is just a preview of what could befall this country if David Cameron was back in power after 2015. Because he lost 26-2 over that, he has to win 28-0 to get reform of Europe. Unanimity. No chance for David Cameron. He's got no chance of fighting for this country. Because people think he's got one hand on the exit door, and his strategy has failed. If you want to reform Europe, if you want to change the way Europe works, if you want to keep Britain in the European Union, and if you realise that the biggest threat to our prosperity is now the Conservative Party, the right answer is a Labour government. I'm determined that as Prime Minister, I promote our values all around the world. And one of the things that means, friends, is seeking a solution to a problem that we know in our hearts is one of the biggest problems our world faces. And that is issues in the Middle East and Israel and Palestine. I tell you, I will fight with every fibre of my being to get the two-state solution. Two states for two peoples. Israel and a Palestinian state living side by side. That will be a very, very important task of the next Labour government, friends. There's one other thing I want to say about what we need to do abroad. You know, we've made extraordinary progress on lesbian and gay rights over the last 20 years. If I think about the transformations that I've seen growing up into adulthood, it's the biggest transformation. We've got made such progress on equality. But we have to face the fact that internationally, things are, if anything, going backwards. We can't just let that happen. We can't just say, well, that's okay. This Labour government, the next Labour government, will fight to make sure that we fight for our values and for human rights all around the world. So today I can announce that I'm appointing Michael Cashman, Lord Cashman as our envoy on LGBT rights all round the world. So it's about a plan at home and abroad, but it's also about leadership, friends. You know, I know that the next 8 months represent my interview with the British people for one of the most important jobs in our country. Let me tell you what I care about. I care about big ideas that can change our country, the principle of together. I care about hearing the voices of people right across our land and not shutting them out. And I care about something else. I care about using the power of government to stand up against powerful forces when we need to do so. It came home to me the other day when I met Rosie, a doctor from Devon, and she said to me, what we need is somebody who'll stand up for working people, for everyday people, because you'll have the power and we won't. That's why I stood up to Rupert Murdoch over phone hacking. That's why I stood up to the banks over bonuses. That's why I stood up to the payday lenders over their exploitation of the poorest people in our country. That's why I stood up to the energy companies over their profits and prices. And yes, it's why I stood up to the Daily Mail when they said my dad hated Britain, because I know my dad loved Britain. Okay, that's me, but what about the other guy? Now, this isn't a conventional job interview, so I get to say something about him. He stands up for the principle of you're on your own. He stands up for the privileged few. And here's the thing that gets me the most about him, perhaps. He really thinks a good photo opportunity will fool people into thinking that he doesn't really stand up for the rich and privileged, he stands up for you and your family. In this day and age, when people are so cynical about politics, I just think it adds to that cynicism. But here's the thing. He's been found out. He's been found out because he hugged a husky before an election and then said, cut the green crap after an election. He's been found out because he stood outside an NHS hospital before an election with a placard saying, no hospital closures. And he closed that very same A&E department after the election. He's been found out because he changed his logo to a tree before an election and then tried to sell off the forests after the election. And he's been found out because he said he was a compassionate conservative before the election. And he imposed the cruel, the vindictive, the unfair bedroom tax after the election. And you know what gets me even more? You know what gets me even more? Is that even now, with all the tales of misery, hardship, injustice, he thinks a bit of rebranding will get him off the hook. So he calls it the spare room subsidy, as if that will make the problem go away. Well, David Cameron, you've been found out. So friends, there is a choice of leadership at this election, a real stark choice of leadership. Leadership that stands for the privileged few, or leadership that fights for you and your family. And as I said earlier, this isn't just about leadership and government and Labour's plan for Britain's future. It's also about all of you. See, we can't build the country we need without you, without mobilising every part of Britain. So I say to young people, we need your hopes, your energy, your vitality. I say to every older person We respect your service and we need your wisdom. I say to every business, you can be part of this and we can't do it without you. I say to every entrepreneur, we need your ideas, your enthusiasm. I say to every charity, we admire your spirit and we want to hear your voice. I say to every nurse, every teacher, every public service worker, we salute your dedication and we know why you do what you do. I say to every person in our country who believes that tomorrow can be better than today, we need you. Together we bring up our families. Together we look out for our neighbours. Together we care for our communities. Together we build great businesses, the best in the world. Together we teach the young. Together we heal the sick. Together we care for the old. Together we invent cures for the most terrible of diseases. So of course, friends, together we can rebuild our country. Together we can reward hard work. Together we can ensure the next generation does better than the last. Together we can make our NHS greater than it's ever been before. Together we can make Britain prouder, stronger in the world. Together we can restore faith in the future. On our own we can't, but together we can. In the next 8 months, the British people face one of the biggest choices in generations. A choice between carrying on as we are, on your own, for the privileged few, or a different, better future for our country. We're ready. Labour's plan for Britain's future. Let's make it happen together. Thank you very much.
The British House of Commons will be in recess over the next few weeks so party leaders can attend their annual conferences. The House of Commons returns in mid-October. You can watch past Prime Minister's questions or other British programming on our website at cspan.org. Next, a discussion on what Congress might do about domestic violence charges against NFL players. At 11 p.m., Q&A with Sally Quinn, founding editor and columnist for On Faith and FaithStreet.com. After that, another chance to see British Labour Party leader Ed Miliband speak at his party's annual conference.
Our campaign 2014 debate coverage continues live on C-SPAN, Tuesday night at 9 Eastern, for the final Texas governor's debate between State Senator Democrat Wendy Davis and State Attorney General Republican Greg Abbott, and live Thursday night at 8 Eastern, the Oklahoma governor's debate between State Representative Democrat Joe Dorman and the incumbent governor Republican Mary Fallon. Also at 8 on C-SPAN 2, watch the Nebraska governor's debate between Democrat Chuck Hassebrook and Republican Pete Ricketts. C-SPAN's Campaign 2014, more than 100 debates for the control of Congress.
Now a discussion on NFL players charged with domestic violence, the league's response, and what action Congress could take. From today's Washington Journal, this is 40 Minutes.
As the NFL moves into its fourth week on this Sunday, we want to turn our attention to where the organization is, its leadership, and what role, if any, Congress might be playing in the months ahead. Joining us from New York is Kavitha Davidson. She writes for Bloomberg News. Thanks very much for being with us.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Let me begin with the news conference just over a week ago by the NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell, who said that his first priority is, quote, to get the NFL's house in order. On so many different levels, what does that mean?
Well, it actually means very little, frankly. These are words that, this press conference was very widely panned for having a lot of vague answers and kind of empty words, and these seemed like more of them. The NFL has taken a couple of steps in the past few weeks to at least attempt to address its domestic violence issue. It overhauled its domestic violence punishment policy, adding it to the personal conduct policy. It took on three female advisors, a senior advisors, who all have very extensive work in dealing with domestic violence, including the former head of the Sex Crimes Prosecution Unit in New York County. And it promoted one of its vice presidents, President Anna Isaacson, to Vice President of Social Responsibility, and she will oversee the NFL's outreach into communities and education programs and dealing with many of its social programs, including how it deals with domestic violence. But at the same time, the number one takeaway from this press conference was and really should be that the NFL is in damage control, and it's still trying to control its messaging, and it's not doing a very good job of that right now. So I think that we have to take everything that Goodell and that the league says with a bit of a grain of salt.
And much of this really stemming from the situation with Ray Rice and the issue of domestic abuse and violence. This is a piece that you wrote for Bloomberg View about the NFL inviting women to the big boy table. My question is, will it make a difference?
Well, I have been an advocate for a long time for the league to promote more women into higher executive positions. So I don't think that this can be seen as anything but a positive step. How positive a step it will be is still kind of up for grabs here. As I mentioned, Anna Isaacson, a very qualified individual and seems to actually really care about the NFL's force as it can promote some social good here. But so far, all that we've kind of heard from her have been the same kind of empty sound bites and league talking points that we've gotten used to hearing from Goodell and from team owners. So the jury's kind of still out as far as how she's going to really shake up the system. The NFL also promoted, John Hudson to be the CMO of the league. She will be the first woman to directly report to Roger Goodell. So on some level, I think that we can take it as a positive step that he will finally have more female voices that he may or may not listen to. But it's better than where it was before. At the same time, it really shows you what moves the needle with the NFL. As the CMO, Ms. Hudson's number one job will be to to kind of smooth over the relationships that the league has had with its sponsors, many of whom have publicly expressed discontent with the way the league has handled this domestic violence issue. So really, you know, when the sponsors get angry, that's really when the NFL seems to act.
Kavitha Davidson, I want to ask you to respond to this piece by Cecilia Kang. It was published on September the 17th in the Washington Post. How the government helps the NFL maintain its power and profitability. A couple of points: with legislation that was signed into law in 1961 by John F. Kennedy, the NFL remains basically a tax-free zone, although the owners pay taxes, but the NFL itself is a nonprofit. And the NFL commissioner, Roger Goodell, earns $44 million a year.
So it's a little bit complicated, not to get too far into the weeds of it, but to really understand where the NFL is in its relation to our country and to the politicians and to the legislature, you have to understand the origins of its tax-exempt status. The NFL has been tax-exempt since the 40s, but it was really written into, solidified into the tax code in 1961 when the AFL and the NFL were trying to merge. Then Commissioner Pete Rozelle was trying to seek certain antitrust exemptions under the guise of promoting the sport and helping the sport to grow in cities where it hadn't quite reached yet. And in exchange for that, what he promised to certain politicians who lobbied very heavily on his behalf were teams growing up in those cities, particularly the New Orleans Saints. The New Orleans Saints are a direct result of this somewhat quid pro quo dynamic that happened. What happened in the tax code is really a remarkable thing. To clarify, the NFL isn't a nonprofit as a charity. It's considered a nonprofit trade organization. So it falls under the definition of business leagues. What that means is, as you mentioned, the 30 or so other teams do actually pay taxes, but the league office does not. The NFL likes to tout the fact that the teams themselves do pay taxes as a fact to kind of dispel the notion that the NFL is a tax-free zone. But there are a number of fallacies that logic kind of rests on. One, money is fungible. Two, the relationship that the league has with its teams is not a separate separation of entities, separation of powers relationship. For one thing, the NFL league office itself isn't really in the business of football so much anymore. A lot of its finances and a lot of its money actually goes to financing loans and mortgages for the teams to build new stadiums or renovate their stadiums. The tax exemption actually allows them to offer these loans in more favorable terms than otherwise. And the third part of that is, each individual team pays dues to the NFL, and these dues can be written off as a business expense because of the league office's tax exemption much more quickly than if it did not have that exemption. So it's really kind of it's a really big mess. But the NFL likes to tell you that the league office itself runs in the red and doesn't operate at a profit, but it still does benefit the other 30 teams that do run at enormous profits.
So you have Thursday Night Football on CBS. You have the NFL on the networks on Sunday, Fox, CBS. You've got Sunday Night Football on NBC and Monday Night Football on ESPN. So collectively, the NFL brings in about $7 billion a year just from these television deals.
The television deals are a huge part of the NFL's business, obviously, and frankly, that's one of the ways that we can actually kind of start to move public opinion on this. I think the tax exemption is one thing. The tax exemption is separate from an antitrust exemption. The Major League Baseball is the only sports league that actually enjoys a full antitrust exemption, but under the Sports Broadcasting Act, the NFL does enjoy a slight antitrust exemption, particularly when it comes to their TV deals. And as you mentioned, that's the bread and butter of where their money comes from. And that's really, that would really hit the NFL's bottom line much more than even the tax exemption would.
And the other component in all of this, as the debate continues here in Washington, D.C., over the name of the football team, many claim that the Redskins' name is obscene to the Indian population in this country. And now some lawmakers in Congress trying to use that as a way to force Dan Snyder to change the name of the football team.
Yes, it's been kind of It's been a very long political battle this year for over the Washington football team's name. And on the one hand, I personally think that, you know, the data is in. Most Native Americans find this term offensive, and we should stop using it. And on the other hand, I'm a little bit skeptical of politicians using it as a political issue to gain some points with the base, perhaps before midterms. So, you know, I don't know if there's anything that Congress can actually do to force a name change, but I do think that increased public scrutiny again, when the sponsors start getting worried, that's really what's going to change these things. You know, there was a recent South Park episode lampooning the entire affair. Jon Stewart discussed it. So more scrutiny and more public outrage over this is really what's going to force a change, more than anything Congress can really do, frankly.
Our guest is joining us from New York. She is a writer for Bloomberg News, previously with Huffington Post. Her work available online at BloombergView.com. Al is joining us from Eustis, Florida. Independent Line, good morning.
Excuse me. Hello.
You're on the air. Go ahead, Al.
I got an explanation for one of my questions.
Sure.
But the other question is, and I'm kind of irate at this, is why does the federal government involve at all at this? It was explained to me, yes. But why isn't Congress doing something about the people who are out of work in this country and getting industry back into this country instead of getting payola from all the lobbyists to keep it out of this country? How in the heck are you going to get people back to work and build the economy again? As far as I can see, the economy right now is in the toilet.
Al, thanks for the call. Well, let me take his comment and take it one step further, because the NFL does have a strong lobbying operation here in Washington, D.C. How strong, Kavitha Davidson?
So the NFL has spent $1.6 million in campaign contributions over the last two election cycles to various congresspeople. And in addition to that, maintains 26 lobbyists on its payroll. So, you know, while it's nice to see bills introduced to try and repeal the NFL's tax exemption and try to force them to do something on the domestic violence issue, I think the money kind of talks, and the money tells you that nothing's really going to happen and that this is kind of a political issue that's being used for points before the elections. On those lines, however, I will agree that, you know, if Congress were doing its job with the Violence Against Women Act, and if Congress were doing its job, you know, trying to reach across the aisle and get the, you know, every single GOP representative who voted against the expansion of the Violence Against Women Act, then we wouldn't have to rely on the NFL to kind of dole out justice when the criminal justice system should have been doing that in the first place.
From Pittsburgh, Quinton's on the phone. Democrats line, good morning.
Hey, good morning. You know, I've been listening to this incident, you know, especially with domestic violence that's been going on within the last few weeks with the NFL. And you know, it basically stems from that. I don't think Congress should get involved in this, because the problem with the NFL and some of these players today starts when a lot of these gentlemen are young. First of all, they're told that they're God's greatest gift to the universe. They're given all this special treatment all the way from when they're young all the way through college. And if you watch college sports, especially when you look at teams like Florida State with what's going on with Jameis Winston right now and how he's been in all types of trouble with women, and the same thing with some of these other college players, they're bringing profits to a lot of these universities, billions of dollars, especially when it comes to the BCS. So now they go to the NFL. Now, the NFL has already a monster in their hands. So it all stems from when they're little all the way up to they're grown. And until we start getting some of these parents starting to raise their young men to teach them how to be men and teach them that they're not above the law, then guess what? Things are not going to change. It's unfortunate what happened with Ray Rice and his wife in the elevator, but I find it disgusting that the woman still went ahead and married this man anyway. And it's unfortunate that we live in a society that some women, and you know, I'm not talking down on women like this or anything like this, but what about their self-esteem? Is money really that important that you're going to let this man do whatever it takes just for the money?
Quinton, thank you for the call.
I get comments like this all the time. To address, first of all, the end of his question. asking why Janae Rice married him, married Ray Rice at the end of this, is completely the wrong question. It's victim blaming. It's blame shifting. It's blame deflection. But it's also just the wrong question. The question that we should be asking was the first part of Quentin's comment, which was, why was Ray Rice hitting his fiance? Now, I do agree that this problem begins far, far before these players get to the NFL. And Jameis Winston is a really good example of that. Part of it is being told that you can do no wrong, that your football prowess contributes to your worth, that contributes to your contribution to society, and also the ideas of masculinity and whether violence can be compartmentalized between on and off the field. All of that is absolutely true. The reason Congress has a reason to get involved, even though I think it's more for a political points right now than anything substantial, is that the NFL's tax exemption is kind of indicative of how the NFL is seen as being untouchable and greater than it actually is. And sports in general, the underlying assumption in a tax exemption in that way for a nonprofit trade organization is that in some way the NFL is doing social good. And while I'm a huge football fan and I'm a huge sports fan, I think that we can probably argue that the NFL's primary reason for existence isn't to do social good or contribute to our culture. It's to make a lot of money. And it's doing that very, very well, even through all of these controversies. Now, what we see, other than the tax exemption, is certain concessions that are made to various sports teams, not just in football. We see stadium tax exemptions. We see zoning law changes. We see all kinds of things because sports leagues, and particularly the NFL, are able to kind of threaten us with leaving cities or moving or, you know, something that kind of holds a city and you know, our collective culture hostage in a way. So I think the NFL is a rightful target of this, but it's absolutely true that we need to start addressing this at the NCAA level, at the youth football level, and really try to get to the heart of what this issue in the NFL means as a lens for why we have such a big domestic violence issue in society as the whole.
Your colleagues at Bloomberg's Business Week also writing about this and the focus on Roger Goodell. The NFL is facing its worst crisis in 50 years. Why is Roger Goodell so sure he won't lose his job? And one part of the story, the ongoing investigation at the request of the NFL by former FBI Director Robert Mueller.
Well, Roger Goodell has a lot of friends in the NFL because he's made all of these owners a ton of money since he took over in 2006. So there's no reason to believe that his job is actually in jeopardy. Unfortunately, these owners really are the ones who wield the power. Roger Goodell is the man in the front. He's the face of the organization. He is the self-proclaimed, you know, judge, jury, and executioner when it comes to certain aspects of the personal conduct policy and discipline. But at the end of the day, he's really just doing the owner's bidding. And because he's made them so much money and he's pledged to even increase the NFL's revenues, I think his pledge was to increase them to about $25 billion by 2025, which is an insane number if you think about it. There's no incentive for the owners to actually kind of oust him. And frankly, if he were ousted, you wouldn't see any real institutional change. He would just kind of be falling on the sword or falling on the shield, as it were, because these owners are still going to do things in their own bidding. You mentioned the FBI investigation by former FBI Director Robert Mueller. You know, I think that we all hold a lot of respect for Mueller, and you know, he's overseen two separate presidencies, two separate political parties. But at the same time, I don't think that you can really call this investigation independent. For one thing, Mueller's law firm was the law firm that negotiated the NFL's multi-billion-dollar television deal with DirecTV. So, you know, there's already a conflict of interest when it comes to that. But more than that, this investigation is being overseen by New York Giants owner John Mara and Pittsburgh Steelers owner Art Rooney, who are two of the most respected public faces, owners in the NFL, but they're also two of Roger Goodell's closest confidants and closest friends in the league. So, you know, I think that calling this investigation independent is only serves the league's interests, but it's not necessarily true.
And one other note about Roger Goodell, who grew up in Jamestown, New York, along the Southern Tier. His father served briefly in the U.S. Senate following the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy in New York State. Michael is joining us from Bonita Springs, Florida. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me. I'm wondering if you could comment on the Hope Solo incident. She was arrested.